This is Jim Inkster. Coming next on the show, our leadoff guest will be Lucas Spielfogel. He's the executive director of the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition. He's held that position for a year, and he is one of the 40 under 40 from the Baton Rouge Business Report. We'll discuss what's happening with Lucas and his organization when we start our conversation in a few moments. Also, Dan Bornay and John Camp remembering the late, great Jules Demicourt. For three decades, Jules Demicourt was a prominent professor of journalism at LSU. He had a remarkable career in the business before he returned to Baton Rouge. We'll talk with Dan and John about Jules Demicourt, who would have been 70 years old today. And we'll also visit the controversy about Phil Robertson of Duck Dynasty. But now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757. Inkster's show at WRKF.org is where you reach us online. J.C. Kane producing, and a bit later we'll discuss the controversy about Phil Robertson, the Duck Dynasty star who's in hot water over remarks he made in GQ. And we'll also remember the late, great Jules Demicourt. But first, an interesting man who's been in this community about 5 years, Lucas Spielfogel. He's one of the 40 under 40 selectees this year from the Baton Rouge Business Report, graduate of Yale University, and a man who has made his impression in our community in a big way. He is executive director of the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition, but came here as part of the Teach for America program. Good morning, Lucas.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, as I mentioned, you went to Yale. Probably could have worked in a lot of places, and you ended up in Baton Rouge. Did you know much about our community when you arrived?
Not at all. In fact, I had no intention of coming to any particular place when I applied to Teach for America. I put on my application to put me where I was most needed. And when you do that, you are typically put in one of five or six regions, one of which is South Louisiana. And so I wasn't entirely surprised when I got selected to come to this region, but had never visited before or even planned to visit when I landed here to live for 2 years.
With your history degree from Yale University, you were a good athlete there as well.
Yes, I was a recruited athlete for the heavyweight crew team and was ultimately the captain of the team, so that was a very important part of my life.
That's a big sport there, isn't it?
Yes. Crew is a very it's steeped in tradition at Yale, and it was taken very seriously there. Mm-hmm.
So you were born in New York City, I think I have this right, and moved to Boca Raton, Florida at what age?
At 6.
At 6. You're there through high school, 2006, and then you go to Yale. And you're in New Haven, Connecticut, and now you're in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and you're teaching at Baker Middle School as your first odyssey in this community. How was that experience?
My experience at Baker was nothing that I could have been prepared for, that Teach for America could have prepared me for. It was very challenging. It was not an environment that I was used to, and there was a certain level of dysfunctionality that I wasn't used to, but it also turned out to be the most formative experience for me and ultimately what led me to want to stay in this work, in this city, and then take over the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition.
I said you were here 5 years. Not quite.
Not quite.
More like three and a half.
Right.
But you're on your way. Hopefully you'll be here for a long time, and had a bit of a culture shock, I'm sure, when you went to Baker Middle School. Was it unlike any other place as far as educational endeavors that you'd been before?
I wouldn't actually say it was so much of a culture shock. I would say the shock was more of, like I said, kind of how dysfunctional the systems were when I entered into the school and the structure and the lack of organization. But I had a fine time getting along with the students and creating pretty authentic relationships that ultimately, I think, were important in me becoming a successful teacher. So I wouldn't say a culture shock so much as trying to kind of make sure my classroom wasn't getting kind of swept up in the tidal wave of a bit of dysfunctionality.
What was most dysfunctional?
I would just say kind of the normal things that you experience as a student when you're going through school that you don't really think about You don't think about the processes that make a school run smoothly until you see them not running smoothly. And you understand that in order for a school to run very smoothly, there's a lot of components that need to be at work and a lot of people that need to be doing kind of the right thing at the right time. And when that wasn't happening at Baker Middle School, it was evident to me that, you know, something pretty fundamental was missing.
You're there 2 years. What's the racial composition at Baker Middle School?
At Baker Middle School, it was almost entirely African American. I had a few white students and a few Hispanic students, but primarily African American.
So this was, I would think, something different from your previous experiences.
Well, in terms of my own education, absolutely. I went to private schools growing up, and they were majority white private schools. There was a handful of African American students.
So were you accepted? Did you feel out of place?
I think one of the things that helped me to be accepted was the fact that I was very involved outside the classroom. So I was the basketball coach, and that was something that I think earned me a little bit of clout, because I used to play basketball when I was in high school, and the fact that I could beat my students, the fact that I was the best basketball player in the school, I think earned me some credit. Granted, it was a middle school, and I was 22, but
a little bit of an edge. Take what you can.
Yeah, so I think, you know, my involvement outside the classroom, the fact that my kids saw me going to their games that weren't basketball, tutoring them afterwards, I think those actions demonstrated to them that I wasn't just kind of coming for the school day for a paycheck.
Lucas Spielvogel is the name. He is the executive director of the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition, and we'll talk with him about this organization. But after 2 years at Baker Middle and your history degree at Yale, as many Teach for America alums do, they move on to other things and quite often move away from us. Why did you decide to stay?
Well, the truth is that after Teach for America, as Teach for America was winding down, I really didn't have a plan. I really didn't plan on staying and was very confused about what would happen next. I was kind of shell-shocked from the experience of the 2 years. Also, I was inspired, kind of conflicted. But a really unique and incredible opportunity came upon when Daniel Kahn, who is the founder of BRIC, approached me to potentially be his successor as he was planning on leaving for business school. And so even as he presented the option, I really wasn't very interested at first because I was kind of looking to get out of town. I'd actually been through a breakup and was just really excited to just kind of leave. And Dan was very compelling, very convincing, and the work was very aligned with what I was doing in the classroom. And so long story short, one conversation led to 10 with Dan and many of the students that we call fellows, the BRIC staff and the board, and I just kind of got hooked.
So here we are, 3.5 years after you arrived in Baton Rouge, and you're executive director of the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition, and you have been for about a year. Daniel was on this show talking about this organization. It's an after-school mentoring program. How does it work?
It's always a tough question to answer because it's such a comprehensive program, but basically it is an after-school program in which right now 75 9th through 12th graders come to our office and engage in certain programs that we deem, you know, developmentally appropriate. So depending on the grade that they're in, they're engaging in a certain program. Those are called core programs. Those go everything from writing to college prep to one-to-one mentoring to academic support. And then we also have things called support programs, which are programs in which every fellow is welcome to engage, such as college tours, or you know, social events like this evening. We're having a holiday party where, of course, our whole community will be there. So even though it is an after-school college access program, if you were to kind of summarize it, it's very much a holistic and familial organization.
Lucas Spielvogel, that's a great name, and hopefully a name that will be in Baton Rouge for a long time. How many people work with the Youth Coalition?
Our staff, we have a core staff of 4, including myself, and then we have 3 additional staff members that are really part-time. We have 2 ACT instructors, and we also have a part-time college counselor.
All right. Do you have volunteers at all?
We have a lot of volunteers, yes, and we would not be able to do what we do without our volunteers. We have many different kinds of volunteers, but our 2 kinds of most important ones are our one-to-one college mentors, who work one-on-one with our senior fellows to coach them throughout the college process, and also our tutors who provide academic support to our students.
And you have a good track record as far as some of the people who participated getting college scholarships.
Absolutely. We're very proud of our track record and our results so far. Of the 70 students who have been through the program and graduated, 65 of them are still in four-year institutions. So that's a 93% rate of college retention, which is very high compared to the national average of low-income and first-generation students. And we've been able to amass a little bit over $4 million in scholarships.
$4 million. How many kids are we talking about?
That's spread over 65 kids.
65, $4 million. So that's significant. And as you know, having gone to Yale of all places, going to a university of any kind, but especially one of the caliber that you attended, it's a costly endeavor.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're also responsible for two of Baton Rouge's three Gates Millennium Scholars. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so the Gates Millennium Scholarship is one of the most highly sought after and robust scholarships that's available to any high school student across the country. It's a good through graduation, all expense paid, not only for undergrad, but graduate school, and it's support for academics, it's mentorship, it's really the whole deal, and it's very difficult to get. There's about 50,000 applicants per year, and that number is rising, and ultimately only 1,000 applicants are chosen as recipients of the award, and two of them were in our program last year. One was the valedictorian of Capital High School. She's now a freshman at University of Alabama. And the other was very high ranked at Scotlandville High, mm-hmm. and is now a freshman at Auburn.
Well, you're doing great work in the community, and Lucas is a bright young man, graduated, I think, top of his class at Yale University.
No, that's not true.
Well, you were an athlete, so you had other things going on, but. And you're referring to your notes rather than reading from your notes, which is good. And I'm just looking at some of those right now. And what's 93%? What is that?
93% is the like I said before, is the rate of retention.
All right.
of our students. So 65 of 70 graduates still in college.
That's outstanding. That's better than the national average. And below that, you have 83%.
Yes. Yeah, so currently, 83% of our alumni are the first students in their family to be attending college and hopefully the first in their family to graduate from college.
And that's even more impressive because quite often kids who have parents who graduated from college are more likely to go to college and finish the deal. 31,000, what does that mean?
So 31,000 is the current average family income of our fellows right now. So it's just a number to show that we're working with families who are under-resourced, who need our help. But I also want to mention that the families in our organization are an incredibly important aspect of our organization. We actually have a parent board of directors, which is run by one of our staff members whose name is Darlene. She's our youth and family advocate. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think is very cutting edge about what BRIC does is the way that we do leverage parent engagement. We keep parents informed of the things that their students are doing to ensure that they can be as or more supportive to their students as we are.
Now, I have a question from a listener, Gene, who wants to know the colleges that have been represented under the leadership of the Youth Coalition.
Absolutely. So there are many colleges, of course, since there are 65 students. But, you know, Jim, you were kind of poking fun at me before about Yale. But the truth is that we believe very strongly that our students have the capacity to go to places like Yale and to be competitive at those kinds of places. And that's because we have students at schools, you know, of a similar caliber. So a few years ago, a girl had a full scholarship to Wesleyan. We have a student at NYU. Last year, we graduated a student to Stanford. We have three students at the University of Wisconsin. We have students spread across Atlanta at Howard, Morehouse, LSU Honors College, Tulane, Emory. So
very good work. And if I'd been able to go to Yale, I would have gone as well. So I wasn't poking fun at you. Maybe I was just a bit envious. But have a good holiday. And you have a phone number if anyone wants more information?
Yes, absolutely. We'd love for anyone who wants to get involved to reach out. It's 561-289-3493.
We are wrapping it up with Lucas Spielfogel. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And in just a bit, we'll hear from Dan Bornay and from John Camp about the life and times of Jules Demicourt, one of the more remarkable people in this area for several decades, who would have been 70 years old today. But did want to spend a few more minutes with Lucas Spielfogel, the executive director of the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition. You barely got that phone number in as we hit the break, so give it one more time. You might want to mention your website as well.
Absolutely. I'm embarrassed to say I don't yet have a 225 area code, so I hope the listeners out there will forgive me, but it's 561-289-3493. You can also reach our office at 225-456-5752. And for anyone who prefers email, lucas@thebrick.org. It's lucas@thebryc.org. Would love for anyone who wants to get involved to reach out to me.
Well, good luck to you. Let's stay in touch, and congratulations in being one of the 40 under 40 selections from the Baton Rouge Business Report for this year at the age of 25.
25.
Thank
you
very youngest,
much, Jim.
I think you're the second youngest ever, I think. 297-5633, and we're joined now by Dan Bornay, a man who is the voice of the Valley at Tiger Stadium and has been since 1986, so that's 28 years. And in just a moment, we'll hear from John Camp, the Peabody Award-winning journalist. We're talking about Jules Demicourt, who was a professor at LSU in the Journalism School for three decades and taught many, including yours truly, having a profound influence, and a man who had one of the most interesting paths through the journalistic vineyards of any professor of any university. And he died February 8th, 2008, the age of 64, would have been 70 years old today. Now, Dan Bornay, you knew him long before I did. He was a character when he was a young man, when he was an older man. There was nobody quite like him.
Jim, good morning. I feel great, but I sound terrible. I apologize for the voice. I kind of woke up with this morning. But I met Jules back in the late 60s. He had begun experimenting with something called talk radio. He had a couple-hour block on WJBO. He hosted a program, and he hosted it by doing a lot of his own stuff, by having guests, by reading news, and by doing some of the creative things. He began to experiment with some of the really, really innovative things that he ended up, his entire career dealing with, both in radio, television, print, magazines, every imaginable medium. Jules was a modern-day Orson Welles. You know, people compare him to Charles Osgood. He was, in my opinion, he had talent that went far beyond that. He was a true Renaissance man with interests that were boundless, with talent that was literally gift from God, and with tremendous influence on many, many lives.
John Camp knew him as well. In fact, John and Jules crossed paths briefly at WJBO. Good morning, John Camp.
Good morning, Jim. Yes, it was quite an experience. Jules falls into that category of one of a kind. I arrived in Louisiana in 1967, and Jules was then news director getting ready to head off for a National Guard commitment. And the station manager, Dave Davison, brought me in to act as his temporary replacement, at which point, when he returned, we would create a multi-member news department with the two of us. And when he got back 6 months later, we started a program called Topic that Dan referred to, a talk show in the afternoon, and the two of us would co-host it and occasionally do one of a kind. But Jim, Jules was just, he had, as Don pointed out, multiple talents, and he could be very strange at points, and I recall the first couple of times he left newscasts for me to read. And I looked at them and I said, what the heck is this? Because he just made a couple of notes. He followed the pattern of Paul Harvey, and Harvey was something of his idol. And he had watched Paul Harvey come in and do a show from WJBO some years before, and he was impressed by the fact that Paul Harvey sort of did it extemporaneously just with reference to notes. So he decided to emulate him and pass those newscasts along to me, and I looked at these unconnected sentences, and I said, oh, my God, what am I going to do?
Yeah. Well, Jules, like many in the industry, he ended up getting fired at WJBO, didn't he? And it wasn't because of a lack of talent. It was probably because he was pushing buttons that were not to be pushed. Is
defiance.
That right?
Defiance.
Defiance.
Doug Manship the Elder had become very unhappy with Jules. And Jules, by this time, had received a fellowship at Columbia University in New York, so he was basically in the last few weeks of his tenure. And he had Ed Grady Parton, the business manager of Teamsters 5, on the show. And Parton was a lunatic, and he made accusations against some of the most prominent citizens in Baton Rouge without Jules challenging any of the statements that Ed made. And, of course, Manship became very unhappy about that, especially when he started getting calls from the president of American Bank that Jules had labeled as being some sort of crook, and on and on and on.
Not
and
Jules, it was Parton.
Not Jules, but Grady Parton had labeled a crook. And so, you know, Doug called him, and I was at the time covering the 1968 Democratic National Convention. When I got back, I had a telephone call waiting for me from Jules. Need to talk to you, need to talk to you. So I was renting his house in Baton Rouge. And he came out to the house and he said, Doug's fired me, and told me what the situation was. So he departed, and but, you know, one of the memories I have of Jules, and this is probably reflective of his personality, I remember the first news conference I went to of John McKithen. And Jules showed up to cover it as well. And he was wearing shorts, a shirt out that was tucked out, and a Budweiser beer coat, you know, with all of those Budweiser labels all over it, and Brogans. And I said, now there's style for you. This was reflective of Jules' personality. He was as a Dan will attest, he was one of a kind.
All right. Dan downtown. Dan, you're on with Dan Bourdais and John Camp. Hi, Dan.
Yes, hi. Did you know that in the 1901 Jesuit High yearbook, there's a graduation picture of Jules, and he had more under his name than anybody except maybe the valedictorian. But he didn't graduate because at the state rally he got in trouble and was expelled right before the graduation.
Yeah, he said he graduated, I think, from East Jefferson High School. And what did he do to get expelled from Jesuit?
I heard it had something to do with adult beverages, but I'm not sure.
Well, for those who've never had the pleasure of meeting the man, they're probably thinking this is the most incredible rogue they've ever heard about. He was a man of many dimensions, and Dan Bourdais, he was a popular anchorman after his tenure at WJBO on television, and then he became a lawyer and ultimately went to work for the National Enquirer. He had quite a voyage, didn't he?
Well, he really did, and, you know, and just kudos to John Camp and to Jules. They basically invented that format, that news hour format. That was not something that was prevalent in American radio at the time. John, you and Jules kind of stitched that thing together just from your own talent and ingenuity. And, of course, you know, that thing has morphed into what is now basically talk radio, one of the most prevalent formats in all of broadcasting. Jules had any number of careers, and he could have been a success at all of them. Went to the National Enquirer, and and edited that for, several years. And eventually came back and spent, nearly 30 years as a professor in the LSU School of Journalism. So he took this entire life experience of his, and he just fed it into the academy and helped nurture and develop hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of young people. He had a heart for young people. He had a heart for the Lord. He was a deeply religious person. He had a tremendous knowledge of and passion for collecting the currency of Louisiana, all the way back to the Little Picayunes, on through Confederate currency. He helped sponsor exhibits at Hill Memorial. I mean, the guy was just as talented and as diverse as any human being I've ever met.
I don't remember if it was Jules who told me this or someone else, but at the end of his tenure at the National Enquirer, I can't recall the publisher's name, but he was quoted as saying, "Jules Demicourt has given me a tremendous Christmas present. He's decided to resign." Yeah. But, you know, Jules could do these strange things when he was working, I believe it was KNOE-TV in Monroe, where he had a brief career. And on Halloween Day, he wore on the newscast, he was the anchor, he wore on the newscast a skeleton costume or something like that to celebrate Halloween. He would have been in a category of Anchorman 2 and showing up on some of the events up there.
Well, he also, as many know, was an accomplished singer and kind of a composer. Had two of the most synonymous songs associated with this time of the year in any world, but especially in the world we live here in Louisiana, in South Louisiana. J.C. Cain has one of the selections of the unmistakable voice of Jules Demicourt.
On dem first day of Christmas, my true love she gave to me a crawfish in a fig tree. On dem second day of Christmas, my true love she gave to me two voodoo dolls and a crawfish in a fig tree. On the third day of Christmas, my true love she gave to me three stuffed shrimp, two voodoo dolls, and a crawfish in a fig tree. On the fourth day of Christmas, my true love she gave to me four pousse-cafés, three stuffed shrimp, two voodoo dolls, and a crawfish in a fig tree.
Now, that's the Cajun 12 Days of Christmas with Jules Demicourt, T. Jules. Paul Sawyer writes, it's interesting that Jules Demicourt was a professor at the Manship School, the name of the employer who fired him. You worked for the Manships as well, John Camp. You had a very good experience. And Jules was, I had the pleasure of being his student, and then had the pleasure, mostly pleasure, of being his boss. He was a part-time news person at the Louisiana Radio Network from 1989 to 1993, and he was a handful.
Well, you know, in some respects, he may have introduced me to investigative reporting, because when I returned to, or actually came to Louisiana, I had never been here before, in 1967, it was at the beginning of the legislative mafia hearings that were taking place after Life magazine had done this great expose with Dave Chandler and that whole crew at Life magazine investigative team. And there was a labor management investigation going on of Ed Grady Parton. And this was what Jules was writing stories about. And he was creating a lot of controversy because he had some contacts. And I knew nothing about it, but I was intrigued by this entire number of scandals ongoing, and when Jules left, I tried, at some opportunities to do the same, although I was not nearly as successful as Jules was in uncovering some of the information.
Well, I've often thought that Dan Bornay is kind of a modern-day Jules with so many interests. He's been on the big screen. He's a a business titan, and of course a journalist and the voice of the Valley and the Pete Maravich Assembly Center. I'm sure Jules, in one way or another, had an influence on you, Dan.
Well, I had a couple of graduate seminars with him when I was working on my master's. And so, yeah, having known him, you know, as a colleague back in the late 60s, and then having him for a professor in the late 70s and early 80s, was quite a delight, because I got to see him in full form as he led us through our graduate seminars. John, remind me, but when you left J.O. After, who was it that took topic? Was it Jim Harris who came in and took over the radio program from you guys?
No, Phil Oakley actually came in and took it over.
Phil Oakley, Jim, and then I think Jim came after Phil.
Jim came, Phil became the news director after I was asked to take a one-year leave and not come back, and although I did come back, but Phil took over my job, and then we had a group come in. Robert Collins was hired during that period of time. Bob Courtney became on staff, and then Jim Harris.
Now, in those days, John and Dan, journalists did things like smoke, and they, in the newsroom, they drank, kept late hours. We don't do those sorts of things anymore. But Jules, he kept up with the best of them, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely.
I think I remember reading years ago, I think Chris Gautreaux wrote a column when Jules died, or shortly thereafter, saying that he had whiskey cured baritone or something like that. It was a great way of showing that Jules, yes, did indeed keep up with the best of them.
Well, let's give one more listen to Jules Demacourt, who is a man who is a staple during the Christmas season. He was born on this date, December 20, 1943, 70 years ago, in Poplarville, Mississippi. He died February 8, 2008, in Baton Rouge, and he will always be remembered by those of us who shared his orbit.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear what happened to me on Christmas Eve last year. It was the night just right before Christmas, and all down the bayou, everything was quiet, not even a nutrient go pity-pat in the water. And inside my house, me and my wife was flat poop out from all that Christmas preparation, and was just about ready to retire for the night. Little garçon, little fille, our little boy, our little girl, was already asleep on the moss mattress, and vision of the fée dodo danced through their heads, them little darlings. Them long john was hung by the log burner with care, in hope that St. Nicholas soon would brought himself back.
And we shall return in 90 seconds and discuss what's happening with Duck Dynasty. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. In studio is Mike Wolf, the well-known attorney from our area, who is a libertarian and quite often opines about social matters in the world at large. And the biggest story in Louisiana this week has been the Duck Dynasty controversy. The Star, Phil Robertson, made statements that have cost him his job, at least for now. He's been suspended, and he has people who say good riddance, and then he has others like Governor Bobby Jindal who say, hey, wait a minute, this guy's got a right to say what he wants. And of course, I'm sure Governor Jindal is trying to embrace the supporters of Duck Dynasty, who beat the Jindal machine pretty handily a few weeks ago in a congressional race in Louisiana, as Vance McAllister defeated the governor's chosen candidate, Neil Reiser. One of the statements from Mr. Robertson in GQ magazine says, don't be deceived, neither the adulterers, the idolaters, the male prostitutes, the homosexual offenders, the greedy, the drunkards, the slanderers, the swindlers, they won't inherit the kingdom of God. Don't deceive yourself. It's not right. Your thoughts, Mike Wolf.
Well, those are his religious ideas. People are debating whether he should have been disciplined by A&E. And you hear a lot of people talking about his freedom of speech possibly being infringed. But I don't really have a dog in the fight. I think we should all remember that A&E has freedom of speech rights, too. That is the network that produces the show and the cable network and the broadcast stations and so forth that relay it to the public. And I think it's largely a matter of taste. They can decide who they'd like to have on the show, and if they find someone offensive, well, they can take them off. And the question of the wisdom of his views is a completely different subject.
Well, A&E is only going so far. This show, after all, does have 14 million viewers, and the suspension will not apply to shows that are already in the can. They are scheduled to air as scheduled, and then we'll see how long the suspension will. The story in the New York Times today says that the suspension will affect only future episodes, which have not been shot and will not be seen for months. So they at A&E may be hoping that this blows over, but some are saying, come on, you kind of know what you're getting. It's not like this was a huge surprise, was it, Mike Wolf?
I would think not, although I don't follow Duck Dynasty. I have seen an episode or two, and I am pleased that we have such productive people in our media industry here in Louisiana. But I think his views appear to be pretty ridiculous.
297-5633 is your number. Now, Governor Jindal says, it's stunning to me, after all those antics, that Miley Cyrus would still be on TV and Phil's the one getting kicked off. To me, it just seems a little backwards. He's a friend. I think his heart is filled with love. As governor of this state, I wanted to speak out for a fine Louisianian. A fine Louisianian who has a lot of support in this state and elsewhere. Governor Jindal, of course, is quite likely to be a presidential hopeful, but I don't think weighing in on this controversy is necessarily a good thing for his White House aspirations. Just personal thought. Mike, what do you think?
I don't know. I suppose not. People were speculating on television yesterday that he wanted to avoid using the word homosexual and so forth in order to not have clips taken with him saying things that could be made fun of. But he's made his bed and has to sleep in it. You mentioned the 5th District race. I think when we discuss Phil Robertson, we have to realize we can thank him for Vance McAllister being a congressman up there rather than Neil Reiser, and that's a substantial distinction. And you don't balance a stupidity with a wise action, but if you're going to look at the whole picture, you've got to consider the whole man and not just what he might have said in a dumb moment. After all, if you want to speak of dumb moments, you can go all the way up to the top of the national government and find plenty of them.
you kidding me. Here's another snippet from Mr. Robertson in GQ. He says, on black people, they're singing and happy. I never heard one black person say, I tell you what, these doggone white people, not a word. He says, when he was around as a kid, it was pre-entitlement. They were happy. They were godly. No one was singing the blues. What kind of world was this guy living in? He's a guy who grew up in the 50s and 60s. Some would say he ought to know better than this.
Well, yeah, it doesn't seem realistic. People have been commenting that the views on race seemed as dumb or more dumb than the views on homosexuality. But he's obviously just pulling out a little, trying to be provocative, pulling out a little bit of the total picture of what he's describing and discussing only it.
Okay. 297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Governor Jindal and Sarah Palin, they were the first two out in front supporting Phil Robertson for his remarks, saying that he should not have been punished, and the governor, and I was not at the press conference, but I don't think he really weighed in on whether he agreed with Mr. Robertson, but he in the past has made remarks himself that indicate that he's against gay marriage. He is a right-wing conservative, the governor is, and probably so. So my guess is that he will not criticize the essence of the remarks. Right now, he's making it a free speech issue, which is a whole different matter. In fact, John West writes Will Jindal support the beleaguered Robertson family? I support the free speech rights of anyone, no matter how ill-informed his views may be. Gay advocates who say the Robertson patriarch should shut up and get in line have no place in a free society. So does he have a right to say what he said and not pay the consequences? What would happen, let's say, if somebody in the government working for Governor Jindal made remarks about the governor, maybe criticized him and ridiculed him in some way? Do you think that person would be around for very long, Mike Wolf?
No, probably not for long. But it brings up the larger matter of intelligence in the society. Why do we tolerate dumb views? Well, because we're dumb. One thing, a lot of people have those views.
297-5633. JC, can you show me who is next in line? It is John in Livingston. John, good morning. You're on the air with Mike Wolf.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
Well, I respect the religious rights of anyone and their free speech, but I think what's going to really be interesting here is what the cost of their religion is going to be, or what price they're willing to pay, because obviously you can't walk in any store today without seeing Duck Dynasty merchandise. So Mr. Phil Robertson will probably stand by his views very firmly, I would guess. But I'm curious to see what Willie Robertson, who obviously is CEO of the company, Willie Robertson and his clan are probably making millions of dollars off of merchandising. Will they distance themselves from their father to keep making that money, or will they be willing to put their money where their mouth is when it comes to their religious beliefs?
Okay. A good point. In the New York Times today, it says Willie Robertson said he often had to remind his father that the show was not intended to proselytize. He said he reminded his father he was Phil Robertson, not Pat Robertson, and this is not the 700 Club. It's a comedy show. And you talk about the merchandising involving Duck Dynasty. Walmart sells Duck Dynasty items in 6 departments in all its stores. By the way, attempts to reach Walmart for comment were unsuccessful as well. And the Duck Dynasty Christmas album, I'm sure that Mike Wolf has in his collection, it's called Duck the Halls, prominently featuring Phil, has sold 600,000 copies already. And retailers, Mike Wolf, this being America, expect sales to skyrocket because of this controversy.
I'm sure they will. I'm sure they will. You bring up the matter that it's a comedy show, really. I think a lot of these issues could stand a little more sense of humor, and if we treat them a little more lightly, it makes it easier to handle these kinds of social cleavages.
Social cleavages, that's a nice way of putting it. Richard notes that Phil Robertson made it, and Edwin and Trina Edwards did not on A&E, so that's a point well taken. Their reality show, The Governor's Wife, did not fare as well.
No. But again, you never can tell.
297-5633, HB in Denham Springs. Hi, HB.
Good morning, gentlemen. Just a point to bring up and see what your guest has to say about it. Recently in Denham Springs, last year and this year for a short time, a lady displayed the finger in her light on her roof, and her actions was upheld by the courts. What is the difference between her actions of doing that and Mr. Robinson's statements? Thank you, sir.
That's a very good point there. Similar behavior. And it brings up the moral issue. The real moral issue is how we treat one another. And how are we going to treat people who are different from us, like, say, a heterosexual reacting to a homosexual or vice versa, or people who have dissenting opinions in the community? But someone who has a dissenting opinion needs to pay attention to the community, too, and not try to disturb their peace and calm. And putting an obscene picture on top of a roof is obviously provocative to neighbors and not a very neighborly thing to do, even though it's a matter of free speech.
What does this say about Louisiana to the national audience?
That's a good question, but you could ask that about many of the statements that have been made by our governor and many other people in this state. We're not very particular about reason and objective analysis in this state, but we have to tolerate those who have peculiar opinions.
Well, in the New York Times account, it says several critics of the A&E decision say Mr. Robertson's position is essentially the same as that of the Pope. But an A&E executive cited the graphic language that Robertson used to talk about homosexual acts and said the overt comparison he made between bestiality and homosexuality prompted the suspension. And I would think that this kind of discourse has no place in American life, but this is a highly popular show with 14 million viewers, the most popular show on cable television. And Mike Wolf, I would say the chances are strong that Mr. Robertson will come back. But will he come back short of an apology? Will he have to apologize and say, I really didn't mean it, or I didn't mean it that way, or whatever?
Well, it reminds me of Don Imus. We'll probably see him pull an Imus maneuver.
Yeah, and Don Imus, who made comments about the Rutgers University basketball team. Those were racial in nature. And it was immediate, it was swift, and there were no shows in the can with Imus. He was gone. And that brings up a good point, is that perhaps in this society of ours, you can get a bigger pass if you make homophobic remarks than if you make racist remarks.
Well, it may be, and that's one of the underlying issues, though, really, fairness to homosexuals and decency toward our homosexual friends and neighbors. That was probably the most out of line in what Robertson did. I mean, you have to recognize you may not like homosexuality, but you shouldn't malign and denigrate homosexuals who, for the most part, as I understand it, don't have any freedom to choose to be homosexual.
297-5633 is your number. Barrington, downtown. Hi, Barrington. You're on with Mike.
Good morning, Jim. I just wanted to respond to the gentleman from Livingston who called about the lady who had that light on his roof. That is a totally separate issue from this Duck Dynasty fellow. My recollection is that lady, she was being prosecuted or they attempted to use the power of the state to get her to take her lights down or charge her in some way. In this Duck Dynasty business, you have a private citizen and a private company who... The citizen is being sanctioned by a private company. This has right. nothing to do with free speech, nothing to do with the Constitution.
You make a good point, Barrington, but should Governor Jindal have supported the lady with the middle finger the same way he supported Phil Robertson?
Well, if you look at the governor's statement, governor obviously doesn't know the Constitution and doesn't know the difference because he's equating what A&E is doing to this gentleman with a denial of his free speech rights. And so I can't comment on Governor Jindal, only to say that he doesn't know what's going on either.
Well, Barrington's a fine lawyer, too, and I hear you. Nobody's saying he couldn't say what he did. He can say whatever he wants, but usually when we say things, I'm sure if the governor's commissioner of administration called him an idiot, she wouldn't be around tomorrow. She has the right to say it, but there are consequences to words.
Exactly, and I'm sure that this Duck Dynasty fellow knew that, because no large corporation is going to spend millions of dollars producing a show without making sure that the participants in that endeavor know exactly what the boundaries of their behavior, is supposed to be. There are certain things that actors while they're working on a movie or people in a TV show know they can't go out and do, like getting drunk in public or something like that. Morals clause, we've all heard about that. So this gentleman, I'm sure he had some idea that, his behavior was going to be scrutinized, and if he stepped over the line, he was going to get spanked by the network. So all this outrage and everybody talking about his free speech rights being violated is just nonsense.
All right. Thank you, Barrington. Let's try to get one more in. Ken in Clinton. Hi, Ken. You're on. Good morning.
Hi. I think this kind of echoes some things that were just said, but I'm struck by how many people worry about freedom of speech, and they really don't understand that the Constitution deals with the government's infringement of our freedom of speech, not upon one person versus another. So when the town of Denham Springs or the parish, whichever it was ordering that lady to take the lights off the roof of her house, she was creating, that was infringement on her rights by the government.
Mike?
Well, yes, and that was the point I was trying to make initially, that this was a private matter. You have to look at the free speech rights of A&E Network as well. And we, an employer is allowed to decide what's going to be on his television shows. And if he doesn't like the tone of voice of one of his actors or presenters, then he can get rid of him, and nobody's rights are violated.
Well, thank you, Mike Wolf. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and hope you had a great week. Please spend your weekend with WRKF, and we shall be back Monday. Until then, for J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.